Thank you so much. So this is work which is really done by Reza that I'll talk about, and here's a picture of Reza looking very sharp. That's what he normally looks like over there. And this work is also done in collaboration with Eric Anderson, Charlie Baer, Marie Delatre, Gunnar Fabig, and Thomas Mueller Reichardt. But Reza is really the driver of everything. So I'm going to start off with an intro to myself and then how I became interested in evolutionary cell biology. And then most of the talk will be about this work that Reza has done, investigating the evolutionary basis of variation in cell division and spindles. And time permitting, I'll tell you about work which Reza is now in the process of doing, which is about using quantitative genetics, in some sense evolutionary genetics, to understand biophysics of cell division. And this is a thing which I'm incredibly excited about. We're both incredibly excited about. I think this is actually an incredibly powerful and novel way to study either cell biology or developmental biology. And I'll argue actually it's a particularly powerful way to study these issues of scaling, like I believe people had talked about earlier in this conference. So hopefully we'll have some time to talk about that too. All right, so I'll start with the introduction. So for me, I've like long been fascinated by this question of self-organization in biology at many different levels. I'm most interested in this, interested in many different aspects of that, but particularly interested in this question of how molecules come together and give you processes in cells. So how you go from non-living molecules to cell biology. So in my lab, we study one very particular aspect of that. We study cell division and how that happens, particularly in the spindle. So cell division, I'll just start at the very beginning, just so we're on the same page. Cell division is important. So this is, you know, one cell, when one cell becomes two cells, and in multicellular organisms, well, and everywhere, it's been important for reproduction development, and in multicellular organisms, also growth and even stasis. As you all know, when a cell divides, it's important for its daughters to have a complete complement of the genetic material, and therefore the chromosomes have to be accurately duplicated and then segregated. Right, and so in all eukaryotes, segregation of the, main chromosomes is carried by the spindle. And again, just so we're on the same page, the cell division is divided into different stages based on the changing shape of the spindle. So in prometaphase, you have the spindle starts to assemble. And in metaphase, you have a fully assembled spindle with the chromosomes in the middle. And then in anaphase, the chromosomes become divided into what will become the two daughter cells. So obviously cell division in the spindle is very important for biology, but I think it's also, I'll just put it on passing, I think it's actually also very important for physics, because we still don't understand how a bunch of molecules can actually come together and have these incredibly complicated processes result.
Yeah. Just to make sure that we're on the same page, the spindle is not just the microtubules, it's the whole structure that is built to grapple with.
Yeah, and so it's the whole structure. By far, the main mechanical constituent is the microtubules, but then there are hundreds of other proteins which are important. Orient us. Cell division is very important from a medical perspective. There's a lot of thought that errors in cell division may cause cancers. That's still 100% clear, but there's good reason to believe that may be the case. And it's totally clear that the primary cause for human infertility, particularly age-related infertility, has to do with errors in cell division. Okay, so this is a movie of the first mitotic division in C. elegans. And what you can see is that the spindle assembles and then it elongates and it divides the chromosomes. And you can see as it's doing that, it moves around. And it gets positioned. And in fact, this first division is an asymmetric division. So the center of the spindle is not in the center of the cell. It's off to one side. And the center of the spindle is involved in determining the position of that cleavage plane. So in my lab, we study many aspects of this process, both in C. elegans, which is what I'll mostly be talking about, or in nematodes. But also in other systems as well. So we study mostly from, so we do a lot of biophysics. That's mostly what we do in my lab. We try to study how the spindle assembles, how it actually mechanistically positions itself, how it elongates, and how chromosomes are segregated. lately, we've gotten interested in essentially, you know, trying to understand consequences of these activities, and also, in my personal, try to relate the biophysics of these different attributes to kind of larger issues, both on a medical side, and so in my group, we're particularly interested in the relationship of these things to infertility and assisted reproductive technologies, and we do work both from a basic science and applied perspective on that, and what I'll be talking about today, which is the evolutionary biology of these issues. So spindles in different organisms are different from each other, and the question is, you know, how and why. And again, just as a point of background, so the way that we address all of these problems is by trying to do very, very quantitative measurements of the relevant phenomena, which are of a form that we can compare to some type of theory. As a result, we end up doing a lot of, so often we can't measure the things which we want to measure, and we end up doing a lot of technique development in the lab as well. Okay, so let's just say some of the reasons, this is a very personal thing right here. Some of the reasons why I ended up becoming interested in the evolutionary cell biology of spindles. And again, this is just to kind of, you know, like orient you and, you know, maybe hear your own perspectives at some point, either in this talk or later. And so one thing which I became interested in is that, like, you know, whenever you read a paper on like cell biology, or even whenever you write a paper on cell biology, you know, you describe some phenomena, and then like in the last paragraph, you say, aha, you know, like the reason microtubules are so dynamic is because it must be important for the spindle. You know, like it must be involved in some, you know, like error correction or whatever, right? And so you often kind of, and so there's often these kind of speculations, which essentially are evolutionary speculations. But the question is that, like, you know, are we limited just to these wild speculations, or can you actually say something solid about, you know, why the spindle is how it is? then another thing which, you know, got me interested in this evolutionary cell biology was just, you know, so I mentioned in passing that you know, like we work on different model organisms in labs. So we work on C. elegans, we work on Xenopus egg extracts, we work on mast oocytes and human cells. And if you actually look at the spindles from these different systems, they look differently from each other. So that naturally leads to the question, why are spindles in different organisms different? This is not organisms that we work on, but just to illustrate, you know, so, and as, you know, going from Joel's talk, you know, these organisms are all, in the grand scheme of things, relatively closely related to each other. And you see huge differences from these pictures in the morphology of the spindle. These are all metaphase spindles.
Yeah. Which is, have people started to move over into some of these more...
No, so...
No. These are exotic.
No. Definitely. So there's very cool things known about other species. I myself have a fascination with diatoms, which I think the spindles aren't particularly interesting. But there's many other organisms which have really interesting spindles, which are even more different. I think that would be another talk in and of itself. I don't know, 60s and 70s, people did a lot of like EM of different organisms, and you can see huge differences, much larger than these differences, yeah. Oh, no, that's the same scale bar for everyone. Oh, no, that should be microns. No, it's a really huge spindle. Yeah.
What's the weirdest spindle
you've got? Okay, so one of my favorite, and I always forget the name of this guy. One of my favorite is it's someone who's one of these organisms who, again, I name always forget, who's inside the gut of a termite. And so one thing which is interesting about variations in the spindle is how the nuclear envelope behaves, right? So in budding yeast, this is what people refer to as a closed mitosis, because the spindle assembles inside the nucleus, right? In humans, it's what we refer to as an open mitosis, because the nuclear envelope breaks down and the spindle assembles. And this one guy whose name I can't recall for termites, what happens is the spindle assembles outside the nucleus. The nucleus never breaks down. The kinetochores stick in the nucleus, and the entire nucleus is divided on top of the spindle. So I think that's one of the coolest ones. But there's a bunch of other really interesting ones as well, definitely. I mean, yeah, like I'll mention one thing with diatoms I think is cool, is that if you look at the if you take a cross-sectional EM of any of these spindles and look at the microtubules, they would look very disordered. They're orientationally highly ordered, but they'd be positionally quite disordered. For some diatoms, if you do a similar EM, they're essentially crystalline. Microtubules, so highly, highly ordered. So yeah, there's a lot of cool stuff. Okay, so there's all these variations in the size of the spindle, the shape of the spindle, how the spindle moves around. And as I was alluding to before, there are large variations in the behavior of the nuclear envelope, and then how centrosomes, equivalents behave in these different systems, as well as the behavior of microtubules, as well as basically anything else you can think of. Yeah, and then there's cool things from one factoid from a molecular point of view. So these are more morphological. Is that so? From people who study the spindle, the way we tend to think about the spindle is microtubules and motors and other things which regulate the behavior of microtubules, right? But there is no mitotic motor that's universally conserved, and so whatever one you think of as really important in the spindle, like dynein, we all think of as important. Flowering plants don't have dynein. Egg 5 we think of important. I forget who doesn't have egg 5, but there are definitely some organisms which don't have egg 5. I think flowering plants don't have dynein. Yeah. okay, and then another question is which I'm particularly interested in, I'm not particularly interested in all of these, but I'm very interested, is really how can one combine cellular biophysics with evolutionary cell biology? And so what I mean by this is that in cellular biophysics, normally what the essential goal is that you have some process which you're studying and you get some model of it, which means that it tends to mean that you have some partial differential equations which have some parameters that describe how your thing behaves, right? And then then you're happy with your cellular biophysics stuff if you've established such a model. But then in evolutionary cell biology, I would argue what we care about is how these parameters change over either in a population or how they change over time. And what's the right way of formulating that, I think, was a really interesting one. And one kind of in my mind, quote, which I think is interesting, which kind of brings us, has a certain perspective on this. So Brian Charlesworth, who's a famous evolutionary biologist, he wrote a book review of a book by Kirshner and Gerhardt, and he said the following. So he says that in their book, they argue that the basic properties of cells and their interactions during development have profound consequences for the properties of the variability available for use by selection. And then he goes on to say, until we have a predictive theory of developmental genetics, our understanding of the molecular basis of development, however fascinating, sheds little light on what variation is potentially available for the use of selection. All right, so one may or may not agree with this particular statement. I mean, I certainly appreciate the sentiment. I think maybe it's a little too extreme. But what I personally find interesting is it says, until we have a predictive theory of developmental genetics. Okay, but that begs the questions, once we do have a predictive theory of developmental genetics, then what do we do with it, right? And so how do we really incorporate it into evolutionary framework? And so I think what he's means essentially is that, you know, is that you want some theory which tells you essentially, you know, what people in this type of area would call the genotype to phenotype map. You want something, you know, given, you know, like genetic changes, how do phenotypes change in some real like predictive fashion. So right now, you know, we don't really have this for anything one could argue, but I think we're not necessarily, I think it might be possible to develop such a thing, particularly in certain like isolated circumstances. But then again, the question is, what do we do with it once we have it? So one could certainly argue that, yeah. But still, just saying, like, you know, in a best case scenario, like, then what do you do? Yeah. Okay. All right. So that was all kind of background in motivation, and now I'm going to kind of get to the heart of the matter and talk about work that Reza did, investigating the evolutionary basis of spindle diversity. And then again, another way what one could phrase this question is that, you know, so again, you know, in lab, you know, we're studying mechanistically how all these processes, you know, work in some biophysical sense. But then the question is, you can ask, well, for all these different processes, why are there differences in spindle? You know, so why are the differences in how spindles assemble, position, elongate, segregate chromosomes, et cetera? And so what do I mean by that? So I'll just throw out some like random possibilities. So, for example, you could hypothetically imagine that the position of the division plane is important for developmental differences, right? And so, what I mean by that is that, you know, if you look at different nematodes, there are some guys who divide symmetrically and some guys who divide asymmetrically, and one could hypothesize that this is going to have really important developmental consequences, and therefore the reasons perhaps why some guys divide like this and other guys divide like that has to do with something that's important for development later on. That seems like a reasonable possibility.
Exactly.
So I'm just going to throw out some random stuff, and you're totally right. All right, so one could imagine that another, you know, another things about why things are the way they are is that, you know, maybe there's some trade-off between, like, you know, so the speed and accuracy of division. So some guys go through cell division very, very quickly. Other guys go very, very slowly, and maybe there's some trade-off, right? And so, kind of alluding to what Rob was getting at, these are both adaptive possible explanations, and one could think of many, many, many other possibilities. But there's plenty of non-adaptive possibilities as well. And so one possibility, and so for example, like Eric Carcenti has written a lot about how he thinks that people emphasize adaptive changes too much, and he thinks that just kind of the intrinsic self-organizing nature of the spindle results in a lot of the changes over evolution that people see.
Do you think we can settle these things?
Yes, and so this talk will be about settling these things. But I just want to first throw out a bunch of different possibilities. Yeah. Yeah. Yes, and then as Rob was saying, that you could imagine that some of these things just don't matter, and hence they're essentially evolved in a neutral fashion. All right, but then the question is, okay, like how do we settle these things, right? How do we tell which of these are right, or if something else is right, or whatever? All right, and so in other words, what is the evolutionary basis of spindle diversity? And so then we have to think about a little bit like what's actually happens over like the evolution, and so you know the idea is that, you know, a long time ago, so we have different organisms who have their different, you know, spindles today. A long time ago, well, what happened is that you had one organism which had one spindle, or you know, one type, one or population with, you know, spindles in that population. And then over time, you know, evolution happened, and that resulted in these different guys, right? So over time, you started in one state, and then evolution happened, and you ended up with all these different guys today. And so then basically the question is, can we kind of unpack this to learn about what was happening here, right? And so the work I'm going to tell you about is essentially, you know, work that Reza did to do that in one particular clade. And so, like, obviously, you know, like, and, well, you know, spindles exist in all eukaryotes. You know, we're not going to tackle that problem in, over all eukaryotes, but just to start with a particular group.
Can I just say something else?
Yeah. Yes.
Like, if you were looking to look at somaticides, you'd be bigger than human
spindles. Yeah, not totally. Yeah, that's another really important point. Yeah, and so like within an organism, spindles in different tissues can be quite different from each other. In their morphology and their behavior, and in some of the molecules which are important for how they behave.
So, you see sort of a series of pictures over there, and they
will
resemble each other.
Well, so for example, like if you look at, so one of the largest differences in, oh, so there are many differences if you look like the human body as just one random example, but one of the largest differences in humans would be between female meiotic spindles and a random mitotic spindle. So like those are can be hugely different from each other. But it's also true that different mitotic spindles are also can be quite different from each other. Okay, so I haven't seen any kind of like formal, you know, study, but I think it's safe to say that everything we call spindles are very, very, very likely one origin for all of them. Which is another part. I'm not going to be talking about the origin of the spindle. I'm talking about the diversity over in some finite, you know, like some, well, in this case, some small region of, you know, possibilities. Hundreds of other proteins, yeah.
Are those proteins the same proteins from organism to organism?
And so many are the same, but on the other hand, yeah, there are a lot of differences. And so in the sense that like, I mean, I have to think about it, but like, I would say there are very few proteins which are universally conserved in every eukaryote involved with it. So certainly tubulin, probably gamma tubulin, but even ones that, so like, for example, like in the kinetochore, there's one, the structure which connects microtubules to the kinetochore, the NDC80, is highly, highly conserved, and that's conserved through most of eukaryotes. But I think it's trypanosomes don't use NDC80. They have some other mechanism for coupling microtubules to the kinetochore, which is currently being studied by, you know, people. No, I want to make clear. Most of the proteins are the same, but no one, but you'll always find someone who doesn't have it. And so it's a bit of a different statement. Yeah. Yes. That's a fantastic question, and I would say right now we don't know the answer to that.
Yeah.
Okay. So one question was, is that like, if there's a protein which someone doesn't have, which an organ doesn't have, is there another protein which kind of fulfills the same functional role? And the short answer is that I don't know, or I would say people don't know. That's certainly an interesting and a very reasonable hypothesis, but I would say it hasn't been established. Okay.
Regarding that, for example, the people who are studying the losses, they don't have binding, but they have some kinesin that has those two minus end of microtubules and they have the same function.
Yeah, and so definitely, these same kinesins, these kinesin 14s, are in fact present in many, many other organisms as well, yeah. And so, but maybe that, you know, dynein got lost and kinesin 14 kind of takes its role. It's certainly very reasonable. I don't know if that's been really established, or I would say I don't think that's really been established that's what happened, but it's certainly very reasonable. Okay, and so now basically we're gonna try to unpack like what we mean by this over here. Right, and this is going to lead us to what Reza actually did. Okay, so of course, you know, like all genetic, all variation ultimately starts as a spontaneous mutation. So spontaneous mutation is the ultimate source of variation. Then these, mutations are acted on by selection, population dynamics, genetic drift, and other processes. And together, You know, this stuff on short time scales gives you within species variation, and on long time scales gives you between species variation. So I think you know, this is a fairly well concise summary of evolution. No, so recombination would kind of go in here, and so it's kind of like variations being mixed up. Yeah, and so that's a form of mutation. Yeah. Right. So, but you need to have things to kind of recombine that are different. Like, because if you had two things which were identical and you recombine and they're the same thing, then they're still the same thing. I mean, yeah. But again, it's a little bit semantic, perhaps. I don't know. Okay. So then what the idea is to try to characterize these within one clade and then try to see if one could figure out what's going on, right? And so this is what Reza has done, and that's what I'll tell you about. And so the place which he started was to ask how much within species variation, in fact, do you have in the spindle, right? As far as I'm aware, we know, or I'm not aware of nearly for any, or for very few cell biological processes, I think was a safe claim, do we know much about within species variation in them. So Reza investigated this by studying the extent of within species variation of the first mitotic spindle in C. elegans. All right, so if you want to study that, you have to be able to do really good measurements of a lot of individuals. And so Reza developed a way to do high throughput imaging of the first mitotic division in C. elegans. And so this is what you're seeing right here is one plane of a 3D DIC movie, where if you focus on one guy, you can see that you start with pronuclei, which move together. Then you get the spindle, which positions and oscillates. This guy, the movie didn't go long enough for this guy to divide, but then the cells divide. All right, and so Reza developed a way to do this very high throughput. It has taken movies more than 20,000 embryos going through division. And again, these are 3D movies. All right, and then furthermore, he developed a way to automatically track the behavior of the spindle in these movies. And I have to say that this is actually much, much harder than it might look, because doing image analysis on DIC movies is very, very challenging. But Reza has a very robust, very good way of essentially tracking the position of the centrosomes, as well as looking at the division plane and other aspects. All right, so then for each of these 20,000 embryos, you can watch how they behave in detail. And so, for example, you can look at how the spindle elongates as a function of time. So you start at some initial length, you elongate, you get to some final length, and then you can see that, for example, the spindle oscillates, and you can measure the oscillations, as well as you can measure the size of the centrosome and where the division plane is, and many, many other attributes. Oh, right, yeah, sorry. So the oscillation is this going up and down. And so as it's elongating, the spindle is going up and down like this, and it's moving asymmetrically. And so that's...
But hold on, it's also rotating. So, I'm sorry to be pressing on the details, but how do you... What's elongation defined as? The line joining...
The distance between the two centrosomes, and now this is the oscillations that you're seeing. Yeah, and so the way you define the oscillations in this particular case is that when the spindle is lined up, so now we see it's going up and down and up and down and up and down. When it's lined up, you can define an axis, and you can simply look at the height, in this case, of one of the centrosomes as a function of time. Well, in some sense, that's one of the questions, right? You've asked an evolutionary question, and then is this a neutral thing? Is there some reason? Yeah. Oh. Here, this is just arbitrary. So this is just arbitrary. There's no meaning to the shift. And so there definitely is a way to align, or one could try to align on various time points. Here, in this particular analysis, that was not done. But one can certainly, for example, talk about when the pronuclei meet or other processes. But in this particular analysis, that wasn't done yet.
Is this for a single nucleus, for a single spindle?
Yeah. This is data from a single guy. Yeah, it's from a single guy. Right. And so C. elegans is they can be males or hermaphrodites, and when they're hermaphrodites, like when they're at the right stage, if you cut them open, then you have some early embryos that just kind of pop out, and then if you're very 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 fast, then you can place those. You know, you cut up a bunch of guys and you can place them on the microscope, and then you can do imaging. There's this clear region, which we believe corresponds to the centrosome, the size of the centrosome. And one evidence for that is that if you use fluorescence microscopy and look at a known centrosomal marker, the size of this clear region is the same as the size of that centrosomal marker, essentially. So actually now Reza has a kind of better algorithms, and so I mean they do fluctuate because of errors, but that actually doesn't lead to huge. So there are errors in the tracking. Like you could see some guys going off here and stuff like that. That definitely makes the data not as good as one would like, but it's not insurmountable. That could be informative. Yeah. I think. Like in general, definitely like looking at fluctuations is hugely powerful. I think here, like it would be a little bit challenging to disentangle real fluctuations from simply just errors in the tracking. Okay, and so then you know there's a population of people now, or a group of people now who do population genetics on C. elegans. And then we were able to, you know, make use of their resources. And so basically, so what Reza did is that he studied a panel of wild isolates, so 100 C. elegans wild isolates, which have been collected from all around the globe by many, many groups. And all of these 100 wild isolates have been sequenced. Right. And so then basically Reza is studying how does cell division happen in these different wild isolates. Right, so like all these processes which I've mentioned. And the important take-home message, and I'm just going to elaborate on this, is that there's extensive standing genetic variation for spindle dynamics and morphology in the C. elegans wild isolates. Yeah. Oh yeah. So these are definitely the same species, i.e., like you know, people can mate them together in lab. They're all sequenced. These are 100% definitely the same species. There's no question about it. These are all C. elegans. Right. And so it ends up that with C. elegans, so probably because of spreading from humans, there's very very little population structure in C. elegans. And in fact, if you look at the kind of local genetic diversity in C. elegans in like a apple orchard, that's very similar to the global genetic diversity of C. elegans. And if you try to like cluster them, like there's not like strong support for anything local happening. It really seems like it's kind of one population, presumably brought about by spreading with humans. And that's obviously not true for other nematodes. It just happens to be true for C. elegans. Okay, okay. This is the main take-home message, and I'm going to show you evidence that this is really correct, and just elaborate what I mean by that. And so, all right. So, like, these are just three isolates. These are just three isolates, just as an example. Three different isolates collected from. This is one isolate. These are three different individuals. From one isolate collected, you know, there. And if you make a histogram of the final length of the spindle in, I forget the exact number of isolates, the exact number of individuals that was used in this data right here, maybe, you know, like 20 or 30 individuals. You make a histogram of the final spindle length for this isolate. You see it's like this.
What about the sizes of the individuals themselves, though?
Well, so that's definitely an interesting question, and let me hold off on that until later. But now we're just kind of looking at one thing at a time. Okay. Now, if you look at another isolate collected from here, here are three different individuals. And now, if Rez makes a histogram of the final spindle length from these different individuals from this isolate, you can see that this isolate behaves, you know, has a different final spindle length from that isolate, right? So these are both in the same lab environment, right? There's a different final spindle length. This must mean that there is a genetic variation for the final length of the spindle and C. elegans, right? Because different isolates have different final spindle lengths, right? Okay, that's kind of like, you know, getting us going. Similarly, if you look at oscillations, so you can look at, you know, one isolate and you can see it has very small oscillations. Consistently, you know, different individuals from that same isolate has very small oscillations. You look at another isolate of C. elegans, it has very large oscillations.
Yeah.
Well, again, so these ones are all genetically identical. These guys are all genetically identical, essentially. Yeah, and these guys are all genetically identical.
But I still think it's a good question, because at least with respect to gene expression, if you get a guy that's a high expressor, you regrow, and then you look at them, they're going to be a whole broad distribution.
Right. And so, I mean, like, if you look at the same isolate, you know, like if you take it from the fridge different times and grow it up, you know, like this is, you know, like, yeah, that you kind of fall in one population, right? And so there really is different.
Yeah, okay, still, I think everyone's point is if you grab the right-hand guy, I don't know what, I'm thinking of bacteria, but you know,
So you could certainly ask, like, how do mutations change stuff, you know, like But I think the point is that, well, okay, so you're asking literally just the kid of this one. If we look at that, it's definitely an interesting question. So that we haven't looked at. Yeah, so that's, yeah, so that's a great question. And so certainly, yeah, so these things do vary with environmental conditions. So if you feed worms different foods, you can have quantitative changes in these type of phenotypes, or also you vary the temperature, you can have quantitative changes in these phenotypes. Yeah, exactly. So, but this is all, yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. But I'm just starting off just to give people like a sense of just like what the data looks like and what we mean when we say that there are differences. Exactly. Okay. All right. And then similarly, if you look at a bunch of individuals from this isolate, you can see that their centrosomes, well, are, you know, similar in size. You look at individuals from this isolate, you can see that their centrosomes are similar in size from each other and larger than these guys, right? So again, there's genetic variation for centrosome size, variation in C. elegans.
Maybe
one should talk about, do you see this clear region?
Yes, I do.
Yeah, so it's the boundary of that clear region.
Gotcha. Thank you.
But it's an area, not a volume.
Yeah, exactly, so it's an area, exactly. So this is the area of the larger, there's 3D imaging here, and this is the area of like the large cross section. And so we didn't do that. That's one thing one could hypothetically do. Yeah, but we didn't do that. They're more or less spherical. And so one, I mean, so it would be a good guess just to multiply, but we didn't actually like, you know, rigorously look at that. Yeah. Fantastic question. But hold off on that. you're a step ahead of me. All right. But first thing I want to show is that just kind of building on this point is that now, so these are these 100 natural isolates. For each isolate, this is just a rank ordered thing for the isolates from centrosome size of the 197 different natural isolates. And what you can see is that centrosome size varies essentially twofold between over the isolates, so there's 97 isolates. So this is, I would argue, this is huge variation. Well, again, this is within species. We're not talking about different species. There's no population structure.
No, the two guys at the very end are not more closely related to each other than.
Right, and so if you try to make a within species phylogeny, it's not really clear what that means in some sense, right? Because different parts of the genome could have different phylogenies, right? And so, if you try to just make some like average, you know, genetic distance that guys are from each other, no, there's no, yeah, no correlation. There's definitely genetic variation in these guys, and again, all of them are sequenced. It's an interesting question. We don't know. Is the genetic variance responsible for these differences in genes that we think of as being for the centrosome or for the spindle, or is it something more indirect? We don't know that. So then, Reza has the work I'll talk about later on is about trying to do quantitative genetics to try to figure that out. But right now, I would just say there's certainly variation in a lot of the genes that we think of as being important for the spindle, but whether those are really responsible for these variations, we just don't know. No.
Like weather, climate, temperature.
So there's no correlation between the where they were located or temperature of where they were located. Okay. Now this is just kind of observational stuff. Now what we can do is one can try to figure out the genetic variance in centrosome size. And by that, what one means is that, so these are essentially like, you know, you could argue that these are basically phenotypic differences. Some of the variance across these lines can be explained by differences between isolates, and some is due to, you know, like variation within one isolate, or within isolates. And so you can formally partition the variance into the genetic component and the environmental, what people call the environmental component, by doing an analysis of variance. And one can determine the amount of genetic variance one has for centrosome size in this particular case. And one can do that for other aspects. And so, you know, and you see that for all these particular aspects and for nearly everything else, there is statistically significant genetic variance for everything, which is, again, similar to just saying that, you know, different lines are really different from each other, but you can actually quantify how much, so, you know, what's the really. Okay, now related to a question that was asked before, these different attributes are correlated with each other, right? And so for example, if you plot just final spindle length versus embryo size, here each gray dot is an individual embryo, and each red dot is a line average, or an isolate average, if you will, average of all individual isolates. You can see that these two things are correlated with each other. And in fact, one can look at the correlations between all the different traits. And you see that many of these traits are, in fact, correlated with each other. And furthermore, all traits are correlated with embryo size. For the first mitotic division, embryo size and cell size are the same thing, because it's a one-cell embryo. And so you can see that basically every aspect of the spindle which we measure is correlated with cell size or embryo size. Now, one thing I think that's important to realize, though, is that when such a thing is correlated, right, that doesn't mean it's a strong correlation, right? So some of these correlations are really quite weak. I mean, they're statistically significant correlations, but they're weak. And so, for example, if you plot initial lengths of the spindle versus embryo size, there is definitely some significant, statistically significant correlation between these two, but it's a very weak correlation. So the correlation coefficient is about 0.22. That is, and so that perhaps might tell you something about the mechanism of that's a fantastic point, and this is something we'll touch on later on. But just as like a segue into that, you could say that some mechanisms of what determines the final length of the spindle would give you a correlation with initial size, and some mechanisms wouldn't, right? And so then this might start giving you some hint on about mechanisms of what determines the final size. Okay, so that's a fantastic question, that's a fantastic question and a fantastic hypothesis. I would say we do not know what determines the initial size of the spindle in this case. So, we are currently thinking that what you just said might be correct, but no one has shown that. Exactly. And if you look at the distance between those two red cells as a function of time, you see some sigmoidal thing, and then it's just whatever the initial, plateau of the sigmoid is how we're defining the initial length. And so one might want to call that the metaphase spindle, the length of the metaphase spindle, but as strictly speaking, we're not observing chromosomes, we're just calling it the initial length of the spindle. Well, and so basically what you do is that you fit the whole thing, the data is very well fit to a sigmoid, and then you can look at essentially the fit parameters from the sigmoid, and that tells you what this initial length is and what the final length is. But say again? And so this final length, this is essentially after anaphase. Or it's a very late anaphase is a better way to phrase it, a very late anaphase. No, sorry. So that is the position. So like, that is essentially the position of the division plane. Yeah, exactly. And so then, just elaborating on this. And so just because things are correlated, I just want to just hammer on this point just so we're on the same page. Just because things are correlated with cell size, this does not mean that cell size is the sole determinant of these traits. Right. There are in fact many things which presumably determine the initial length of the spindle, but it's just cell size is just one thing which contributes to that.
Just to clarify, these are actually the genetic.
And so here, this is really just phenotypic. We also have the genetic, measurements, but I'm just kind of presenting the phenotypic. Yeah. But this is just for illustrative purposes. But for calculations, of course, we're going to use the genetic one. Yeah. No. Totally right. Actually, it ends up that in this case, the genetic is proportional to the phenotype, which, as you know, people often observe.
Can you ask things like, if you knew the size of the embryo, does it no longer matter which strain it came from?
Fantastic question. So let's hold off on that. Let's hold off on that. But that's a fantastic question. But you kind of get the feel of where we may be going. Totally.
It doesn't have to be
sized. Exactly. Okay, but the take-home message of all that stuff is that there's extensive genetic variation for cell division traits in C. elegans. And this is one thing which I really want to emphasize. That's an interesting point. In my mind, it's a very interesting point, right? So the point is, just so you look around the room, right, everyone looks different from each other, right? We're different heights and stuff like that. So our, easily observable macroscopic phenotypes, like individuals are different from each other. Some of that has a genetic component, right? And it seems that the same thing holds for cell biology, right? So for humans, we don't know the answer to, because we haven't looked at humans. One point which is very interesting is that in C. elegans, there's actually less genetic diversity in C. elegans than there is in humans. So if anything, one would expect more variation in cell biology between humans than one sees here in C. elegans. But again, no one's looked at that, so we don't know. Okay, so now you can ask the question is, what determines the level of variation of cell division traits in the population, right? So I said that, you know, you look across these 100 isolates, your centrosome size varies by a factor of 2, right? Why a factor of 2? Why not a factor of 0.2 or a factor of 20? Right, so what sets the level of variation of cell division traits? So to get into that, as everything ultimately arises from mutations, it's good to understand how mutations affect cell division traits. Right, so that's the next thing which I'm going to talk about, and that's what Reza characterized that. Okay, so how to do this? So the way this is done is by using mutation accumulation lines to measure the spectrum, how spontaneous mutations affect these particular traits. So I don't know if Mike, we probably earlier talked about, I assume, mutation accumulation lines in other contexts. This is really very much using the same, or maybe he didn't. But if so, then this is very much using the same thing. So the idea is as follows, or one way you can phrase it as follows, is that so like the standard way that you propagate C. elegans in lab is that you have a bunch of worms on a plate, right? You let them grow up, you take a chunk, you move it to a new plate, then they grow up and fill the plate, then you take a chunk and move it to a new plate, and you continue that for as long as you want. Now, when you do that, then essentially there's competition between individuals, essentially opposed to selection in lab. So the ones who grew up most on your plate, if there were spontaneous mutations, cause them to grow more quickly in lab, then you know they'll fill your plate, and then when you take your chunk, you're more likely to grab those ones, and then you're more likely to get these guys. And so essentially, the way you normally propagate guys in lab, there's competition between them, which essentially imposes selection in lab. So all you do in a mutation accumulation experiment is you simply propagate the worms differently. So you take a plate of worms. You take off one guy at random, he lays a bunch of worms. Before they have the chance to grow up and lay more individuals, you grab one at random and put it to the next plate. So now when you're propagating them, there is very, very little selection imposed on them because you're essentially grabbing individuals at random. And so essentially, there's negligible competition between individuals, and hence there's very, very little selection in lab. And you know, one can be more formal about what exactly those means, but that's just kind of the intuition for it. No. So there's not selection for fast growth on your own because you have a bunch of individual. So you lay down. Mom. You put down mom, she lays, you know, like 10 eggs, or let's, you know, however, or let's say 100 eggs, just to make, you know, life easy, right? You grab one of those at random, you put them on a new plate. And so it's nothing to do with, like, growth or anything. There's no competition now.
So you grab the egg?
Well, no, you don't literally grab the egg. You wait till an early stage of development, but before they have the chance to actually lay more eggs. And so there really is there's very, very little selection here. It's not, yeah, you should really think of this as almost no selection. No. So this protocol right now has nothing to do with cell division or anything like that. So for example, what Mike has done a lot of is after you accumulate guys like this for a long time, you can then sequence them and look at what type of spontaneous mutations you tend to get. And so that will tell you about like what type of, you know, how frequent different types of mutations happen in the population. And then you could ask also stuff like how do these spontaneous mutations perturb whatever particular phenotype you want to look at. So do we get the gist of it? Boris isn't looking happy? Okay.
So what about the mutations that are lethal?
Yeah, and so those you don't see.
So you don't see those?
That's right.
Do you have any feeling for what's the percentage of mutations that are lethal versus what?
Okay, and so I haven't done a good calculation of that, but I know if I recall the following statement, so our panel of mutation accumulation lines were made by Charlie Baer, and I believe that he started with 100 different, you know, lines, you know, 100 different of these in parallel. After 250 generations, you only have like 70 of those because the other ones have died off. The numbers are something like that, but then one has to do a calculation of what that means. It's a little complicated, but like, that's the gist of it. Okay. Okay. So then, what you can now do is that you can characterize your particular trait across these mutation accumulation lines, and that will tell you how spontaneous mutations change them. And so, for example, now again, like I said, Charlie made roughly 100 different lines in parallel, actually from two different genetic backgrounds. I'm not going to go into the details of that. But so the idea is that you have 100 lines in parallel. Each one of these, you're selecting one guy at random. And then this gives you mutation accumulation line one. This gives you accumulation line two. You propagate these different generations. So for example, just to give you some sense, so imagine, you know, you propagate here. Maybe you pick up one mutation, which makes, I'll just, for the sake of argument, the spindle slightly smaller. The next generation, nothing happens. The next generation, a mutation comes and makes the spindle slightly larger. The next generation, something happens, the spindle gets, you know, like larger again. You could imagine that the length of the spindle is doing some type of random walk, you know, in this one line, you know, or, you know, over time, and another one in this one line, and another one in this one line, another one in this one line, another one in this one line. Then you can look at the statistics across the lines to see how, you know, for example, the variance in the population has increased. Oh, what's it in these experiments? Do you know? What?
3 days.
3 days? Okay.
So
yeah. So luckily these were all made by Charlie. we just got them from him. Okay. And so then Reza, for each of these lines, characterize, you know, 20 to 40 embryos per line and see what happens. So for example, if you measure the elongation rate in generation zero of these roughly 100 different lines, you can make a histogram of the different lines. So in an ideal world, these would all be identical. In reality, you measure some differences between the different lines of generation zero. But then if you do the same thing at generation 250, you can see that there's a broader distribution in the elongation rate. That's just one example, right? So then, you know, one can, you know, essentially do the quantitative genetics and then ask how much variance do spontaneous mutations, you know, change elongation rate per generation. And so one can just, you know, do that right and just say, and then you just figure out that every generation so first of all, it's statistically very significant, the differences across the MA lines, and then one can look at how much elongation, so you can ask again every generation what's the variance in elongation rate that's kind of put into the population by mutations, and you can do that for all the other traits. And you can measure how the mutations affect the covariance between all the traits as well. So what's the covariation between the traits across the MA lines? All right. And so now one has that. And so now the game is as follows. Okay, so now you have a measure of how spontaneous mutations affect all your traits. You know the level of variation of cell division traits. And the question is, you know, like, what's happening in between, right? How does this give you that?
I mean, if you looked at the mutation rate of C. elegans and sort of tried to take the approximate target size of the relevant genes in the genome, I'm just wondering, like, how many actual base pair mutations?
No, so that's a fantastic question. And so am I correct if I'm wrong, but I believe it's like every generation you get roughly one insertion deletion and one point mutation. Is that right? Okay, so every generation you have essentially one base pair change and one insertion deletion.
What,
Yeah, that's in the whole genome, right? Well, one issue is that, like, what's the right target size? So like, we certainly know, genes that we think of as being important for cell division, but it's not at all obvious that those are the ones which are, in fact, responsible for these variations. That's a super interesting question, but I think that's a different question.
Well, I guess you might be able to put some constraint on it, because if you take what you think are the right proteins, so you have any mutations you expect to accumulate there, if it's, like, less than one or something and you're seeing all this variation, then that kind of tells you you're probably missing.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. We haven't done that, but we're certainly interested in kind of going that route. But we haven't done that yet. Okay. All right. So now, okay, the question is, so like, what determines the level of variation of cell division traits, right? So what you can do is you can start postulating models. So for example, let's just propose a potentially crazy model or maybe not crazy model, I don't know, that all these traits that we're measuring are totally neutral, right? That none of them matter. All right, so then one can use population genetic theory, and that tells you that for a neutral trait that's governed solely by drift, you should get the following relationship, that the, and this is kind of a particular version of this, but anyways, the genetic variance of a trait that you see in nature, right, so this should be across the natural isolates, divided by the variation generated by mutation per generation, should be 4 times the effective population size. Where this is some, you know, like characterization of the size of the refer to the effect of population size, essentially the power of drift. And so from sequencing, one can essentially estimate what this effective population size is for C. elegans, and it needs to be 10,000, which means that this, you plug in the numbers here, then the prediction is that for a neutral trait, this ratio should be about 40,000. A neutral trait that's governed by drift, yeah. So one could take issue with a bunch of things. But the point is that this VG, Ressa measured in the wild isolates, this VM, he measured in the mutation accumulation line. So we can simply ask, is this relationship true or not? Right, so if you look at VG over VM for embryo size, it's about 250. All right, 250 is not 40,000. And this is highly significantly, different. If you look for all other traits, this VG over VM is, you know, between 400 and 1,400, which is also very far from 40,000.
Do you have some sort of positive control for that? Like a trait that you are really convinced is neutral, if you do that calculation, do you get 40,000?
Well, so essentially, you could argue the effective population size is kind of like calculated that way. And so like if you was, you know, because you're looking at genetic variations which you believe are neutral, and that gives you like, you know, what you believe to be the effective population size. And so in some sense, like if your trait was as neutral, I guess, as those genetic variations would be, then that would be correct.
Has anyone ever found any phenotypic trait that comes out as being neutral in this kind of analysis or anything?
That's a good question. I mean, like, one could certainly argue that it would be surprising if anything was neutral, like strictly speaking, I don't know, right? But like, yeah, I don't know if anyone has found that anything agrees with total neutrality. I don't know, with, you know.
A number of human morphological traits are.
Okay, so.
There's one assumption here that the populations reach equally.
Yeah. And so we're assuming it's diffusing up and down. Yeah, so there are a lot of assumptions, right? There are a lot of assumptions. But the whole point is that given all these assumptions, which are potentially problematic, it doesn't work. But let's just go on to some other thing. Or no, we can answer a question here. But the point is that the simplest model, let's phrase it this way, the simplest model you could think of, which could be wrong for many, 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 many reasons, it doesn't work.
So I would just be worried to say that it's not neutral because of that, because there are other things apart from
the other. Sure, okay. So one could argue that one of the other assumptions was wrong. That's totally valid.
Could the inner population be amount of food have a role? Because I know that for humans, the final size depends on the amount of food you can eat.
And so like these are all done under one particular condition. And so within that condition, this holds. In reality, in the real world, you know, like environmental factors may certainly be very important.
That's why I'm wondering, because they all come from different regions where the amount of food they would naturally get might
That's all correct. But one could argue that's another reason why this type of model might not be valid. No. And so if you look at sequencing, there's very little population structure in C. elegans. So you should consider, to some first approximation, this all being one population. And so this is a variation that comes out of the of spontaneous mutations. This is a variation you see in natural populations. And so this is essentially a prediction for what the ratio between them should be.
So there's any natural population, and the reference population size in the latter gray term is 1 or something.
Exactly. So that doesn't show up as 1. Well, somehow that 1 allows you to measure the VM, basically.
Okay.
So this argues, okay, something doesn't prove, but this argues that the cell division traits are not neutral. Okay, so one can also argue against other possible scenarios. So for example, one can argue against the idea that these things are, again, one can't prove any things are wrong, but one can argue against the idea that these are due to local adaptation because, again, this lack of population structure, as well as the lack of correlation between these traits and where the isolates were found, or the genetic difference between them, or temperature and other attributes. And one can furthermore argue, so one certainly for this, for the kind of more experts in the audience, that one might argue for, one might wonder in C. elegans, is link selection an important attribute, or an important process of what determines standing genetic variation for these things? And one can argue quite strongly, I can get to the details how, that this is not what causes, that link selection is not important in this scenario. And I can explain how later on. Yeah, I'll explain how. Okay. Now, so, okay, here's another possible model of what might be happening. Perhaps there is one kind of, you know, like optimum, another very, very simple model. You know, perhaps there's one optimum for how, you know, the spindle or cell division should be behaving. And the variation in the population is a balance between mutations kind of keep breaking you away from that optimum, and selection trying to keep you there, right? So that's one possible model, but there's one, you know, you have some optimum, yeah, like, you know, maybe the spindle length has to be exactly right, and the cell size has to be exactly right, and the oscillations have to be exactly right, and anyone who goes away from that, is more likely to die off, and therefore you could have a, what people call a mutation selection balance, maintaining variation in the population. All right. So if that's what you're thinking about, which of these traits could be under, you know, might be under selection? Well, of course, all of them might be under selection. That is definitely a possibility. But let's start off with, again, the simplest possible model and see how far we can go. So I noted before that of all the traits, embryo size shows the greatest deviation from the neutral expectation. And furthermore, embryo size is correlated with all the other traits we measure. So then one could wonder, could it be the case that maybe selection is acting only on embryo size, directly acting only on embryo size? It's a formal possibility, right? And it wouldn't be ridiculous because people know from many, many given organisms that size at birth is under stabilizing selection. And as embryo size for these guys is size at birth, it certainly would not be ridiculous to think that would be happening. All right, so then what would that model predict? Okay, so one can use, again, quantitative genetics theory for this mutation selection balance, and one predicts the following relationship. Again, there's a huge number of assumptions in this model, all of which could be wrong. But nonetheless, let's just see how far we can go. So a prediction that essentially, so if you take this matrix of the variation covariation of the cell division traits, that should equal this matrix multiplication of where G is this variation covariation of the cell division, of the genetic component of the cell division traits in nature, and W is this matrix of selection coefficients. And so the way you could think about this is that, every generation, you know, new mutations are generating variation in the population, and then stabilizing selection is killing off guys, and these two things must be equal at equilibrium. Exactly, and so M is this measured, you know, variance and covariance between stuff and mutation accumulation lines. G is this measured variance and covariance matrices and wild isolates. W is each matrix element tells you how much each trait is under selection. It's essentially a selection coefficient for each trait or kind of combination of traits. Right, so but you could certainly imagine that maybe the size of the spindle has to be matched to the size of the embryo, and maybe that's the most important thing in the world. I mean, it's certainly possible.
Yeah. What's the dimensionality?
And so this would be like a trait by number, like each trait by each trait. And so it would be like, so if you have like five traits you're considering, it'd be a 5 by 5.
I didn't mean abstract.
Oh, I think it's 5 by 5. Oh, you meant the size of the matrix. Yeah. I think these are, I'd have to look again. I think these are up to 5 by 5. Okay. Yes, yeah, right. Sorry. So yeah, because this is assuming some like stabilizing selection, basically.
Yeah, I think that's right.
Okay, so then if we postulate there's only stabilizing selection on embryo size, that says all the elements of this matrix are zero besides the one that corresponds to embryo size. Okay, so that's the prediction, or that's the postulate. So if this relationship were true, if you take all the elements of this matrix and plot them against the elements of this matrix, they should fall in a straight line. Right? And if you do that, then you see that they do. Okay? So this shows you that if all you do is you postulate the simplest possible model of, you know, with all this problematic assumptions, that what you have is stabilizing selection on embryo size that is sufficient to explain the genetic variation, given the mutations that you measure, the spectrum mutations you measure, that is sufficient to explain all the genetic variation in all other traits, essentially. Okay? So if you just postulate stabilizing selection on one thing, that can explain everything else. All right, so that says that stabilizing selection on embryo size can explain variation essentially all other cell division traits that we look at.
So where do you get the GWG from?
No, so W is a matrix which tells you that there's zero everywhere besides one component, which is the strength of stabilizing selection on embryo size. So we simply postulate that that's the form. And then G is measured experimentally, M is measured experimentally. All right? So one can do a further test. Is this ridiculous, this idea that there's stabilizing selection on embryo size? Well, I said it's not because of what we know about ecology and all these other things. But then, so the picture is that you have this, you know, fitness landscape, you know, where you have embryo size, so you have some optimum. If you're either kind of too high or too small, you have a lower fitness. So then what we did, or Eric Anderson did, is that so he, in all the natural isolates, he measured the lifetime fecundity, which is basically the number of offspring each isolate produces. And of all the traits that we look at, that we've studied, embryo size is the most strongly assorted with fecundity of all the cell division traits we look at. And so this is a plot of for each isolate, its embryo size, its average embryo size and its fecundity. If you do a quadratic fit, you get a significant quadratic fit with a optimum embryo size of 51 microns. If you plot the data like this, like some people who don't like it because it looks like all scattery. So one thing you can do to make it look nicer is instead of plotting all the data points individually, you can simply bin them. And then you can just do averages now as a function of distance away from the so-called optimal embryo size, where you can kind of clearly see this quadratic trend. Okay, and furthermore, if you estimate the strength of selection on embryo size from this measurement, it is essentially consistent with what we infer from comparing MNG. And so we have two separate measures of stabilizing selection on embryo size, one based on in-lab growth, the other based on this population genetic stuff, and they give you essentially the same number. Well, because there are many, many things which determine fitness or fecundity, embryo size is just one small component of that. Yeah, but it's not like embryo size is like the most important thing for the organism. It's just a thing which has a component, which is okay. So then what this argues is that that if one simply asserts, or the following, that the balance between mutation and stabilized selection on embryo size is sufficient to explain the variation in all other cell division traits. Okay? All right, so but now then the question is, what about if you look at different species? So we work with Marie Delatre and looked at 40 other species of nematodes of known phylogeny. And this represents, I guess I should have the axis this way, but roughly people believe that this is essentially 100 million years separating the most distant guys. All right? So if you look at, these different guys, they have different sized cells, they have this is really cool, I guess that's a polar body, that's ginormous. They have different spindles, which behave differently across all these different species. And then some of these, there are multiple isolates on. And so some of them, there are multiple isolates, others are just one or two. And then, so the first thing that you can start asking, one thing you can start asking is you can do what people call a comparative approach. And there are different ways you can think about this. Here's one of them. So we know the phylogeny, which means we have some type of time axis here, and these kind of branches really represent some type of distance. Therefore, we could calculate kind of the distance between any two pairs of species, right? The temporal distance, right? And now, or the phylogenetic distance. And so now, the way I think about this is from a very physics-y way of thinking about it, is that imagine that you started a long time ago, right? You had one common ancestor, one guy, right? Then basically each guy is doing some whatever dynamics they're doing, and the spindle is changing as it's changing, and then you get to some final state as we have today, right? So for example, let's pretend this dynamics were Brownian. Right. If they were Brownian, then one could it'd be almost like a scattering experiment. Basically, you look at today where everyone is, how far they went back, and then you can start looking at asking what sort of dynamics, what models of their dynamics are consistent over evolutionary change. This is what people call the comparative approach. And then you can compare with different models. Right. So these gray dots are pairwise differences between different species. This is just for looking at how embryo size varies with phylogenetic distance. All right, so these gray dots are pairwise differences between different guys. The red dots are averages. Right, so this is just telling the red dots of how you can look at the red dots and just say, how does embryonic distance vary with phylogenetic distance? Now we know a lot of the relevant parameters for kind of population genetic models of how you would expect this to vary. So you can write down a model and you can say, okay, if this was really neutral drift, we know how the mutation, we know we have an estimate of effective population size, how would we expect this to vary? And it's this blue line right here. And so there's no way that the variation between species can be explained by neutral drift, that's totally off. You can also ask, if you had one optimal embryo size for every species that was the same as C. elegans, that optimal was the same as C. elegans, how would stuff vary? And that's this green line here. That's also obviously totally inconsistent with the data. But then you can postulate another model. So another model is that each species has its own optimum embryo size. And that optimum is doing some type of complicated, we'll just assume, just for the sake of simplicity, Brownian dynamics over time. And that would be the prediction of this purple line, which is consistent with embryo size, with the phylogenetic distance. So this is consistent with each species having its own optimum embryo size. Right. And so then what would one get out from this fit is essentially the diffusion coefficient. That's what you would get out, essentially. And so that would be like a good guess. That would be a good guess. I mean, like for this analysis, in some sense doesn't matter because it's just how stuff is changing. But essentially, yeah, that'd be.
Aren't you just you're not really saying.
Yeah, no, that's my point. In a sense, exactly. Okay, but now you can say the following. All right, so let's assume the following. Each species has its own optimal embryo size. But let's assume that the statistics of mutations, the way the mutations affect these cell division traits are the same across different lines. Let's just assume that. Then what we can do is we can say, and then we assume that we only have selection on this different optimum embryo size, but we know how, you know, mutations are affecting stuff. Then quantitative genetics theory predicts that what you should get is a scaling of cell division traits with embryo size. So it basically tells you how, if you select an embryo size and that selection changes, how do all the other traits kind of go along for the ride? And so this is a prediction, for example, that now you have a prediction of how division planes should vary with embryo size that has no adjustable parameters. These are all based on things that are directly measured from within C. elegans. And so here is the actual, if you actually plot for different species, their embryo size relates to the division plane. It falls very closely along the line that one observes from this prediction, which has no adjustable parameters. And it's in fact very close to what you would get for a best fit.
So this is better for
the, no, these are different species. These are 40 different species. And furthermore, for all the traits, so for every trait, you predict some essentially correlation between division between trait and embryo size. And again, these predictions have no adjustable parameters. And for every trait we look at, the prediction is very close to what's empirically measured. Yes. And so I'll come to that in the next part. Well, again, because don't forget, this says that, okay. You're saying this relationship between division plane and I'll come to that, right? Okay. So let's look at that. First, I'll just say that. So what this shows is that if you postulate just stabilizing selection on embryo size, that'll explain the variation across all these different species as well. These are essentially correlation coefficients, these would be partial correlation coefficients. Is that right, Rosa? It's essentially equivalent to the slope. Yeah. But it's partial. I guess it's partial. Yeah. No. It's not partial. It's actual. Yeah. Exactly. Okay. All right. So just related to Boris's question, let's think about the division plane issue once more. So this extent of asymmetry, right? So I mentioned in the beginning, I earlier asked, maybe these differences in asymmetry between these guys is due to, you know, developmental differences between them. You can imagine some selectional developmental changes of why this guy's highly asymmetric and that guy's symmetric. But if you simply just plot the division plane versus embryo size, if you just see where these guys fall out, right? They just kind of fall along the curve, right? This argues that this thing doesn't pass through zero, right? So there's some offset here. And so this argues that, again, stabilizing selection on embryo size explains, you know this extent of asymmetry as well. Okay. So in summary, he characterized the effects of spontaneous mutation on cell division traits. And if you simply postulate stabilizing selection solely on embryo size, that's sufficient to quantitatively explain within species variation for all these different cell division traits, as well as the differences between species in all these cell division traits in nematodes. And this corresponds to, as I said before, roughly 100 million years of evolution. Okay. So I'll just very briefly say that there's really cool stuff that you can do to now, I think, like I said, totally novel, I believe very novel approach to biophysics, which I'm not going to tell you about. Yeah.
And so they started as like a single strain. You know, then there was, you know, a single optimum for all of them. And so how is embryo size evolving in that?
Right. Exactly. And so then what? So okay, I think the way that one should, or the way that I think about it, is as follows: is that basically, presumably, what's happening is that these guys live in slightly different environments, and then are based on whatever niches they're in and however they live their lifestyle, they have their own optimum embryo size, right? Okay, so you go over time, and then different guys, based on their different lifestyles and whatever, get their own different optimum embryo size. If you ask how does this optimum vary with time, it's basically doing some like Brownian dynamics. It's consistent with that. And so, but if some sense, if one wanted like a real model of that, that you need like some model of ecology, presumably, or you know, or like how these guys find new environments and niche selection and stuff. Symmetric division. Oh no, this guy is. Okay. I mean, like, it's more symmetric. I mean, it's pretty much, well, because what do you mean by, sorry, okay, so what does one mean by symmetric, right? So, like, so one can mean two different things by symmetric. One can mean symmetric fates, or one can mean symmetric sizes. So the fates certainly are not symmetric, right? But here, like, the sizes are, it's not perfectly symmetric, but it's certainly a lot more than this. No. What? Okay.
General question about the biophysical limits of how do you confirm that with natural selection in this case? Say you were running an MA experiment for a long time, presumably variance would stabilize because there's no, you can't get any, you know, you can't have phenotypes that are so different that you
can't. Well, that's an interesting question. Maybe. Well, first of all, I would say that's not obviously that's correct, right? So because if you run imagine if you started with like, you know, whatever, 10 to the 20th lines, right? And you evolve these totally neutrally forever, or not forever. Okay, a lot of them are going to die off, right? But don't, I mean, cell size is going to be changing, embryo size is going to be changing, all this other stuff is going to be changing. It's not obvious that one is going to see any type of plateau. If you go back long enough, you know, right, mutations, you know, like, you know, whatever, our ancestors were some single cell organism, and now we're us, right? And that was done by mutations, right? I mean, it's not obvious that, like...
I'm not saying
so,
that's why I'm asking.
No. So it's certainly an interesting one. But I would say...
It means that the mutational variance would inversely increase as you would run the experiment, because you hit the barriers of what's possible in terms of phenotypes for. Because biophysically, you can't get longer spindles or whatever.
And so it's certainly okay. So I would say okay. I think that's an incredibly fascinating question, right? So I would say like first of all, I don't know the answer. Second of all, I would say like here's when I said this bit about combining biophysics with evolutionary biology, right? Here's what's something which I would love to do, right? This would be like my dream, right? So like people know a lot about like fluid flow, right? And based on that, you can make estimates about like how like whatever swimming should vary, how swimming mechanisms should differ with like size of the organism, right? If we had a real predictive biophysics of like the spindle, you should be able to make similar predictions about how like the spindle, you know, like what those like limits are, right? You know, our models aren't as good for cellular processes as they are for, you know, fluids, right? But I think that would be awesome if we could do precisely that, yeah.
I think we should stop with awesome.